Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 20th of June, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish, and we're delighted to be joined by Vanessa Beely.
It is International Refugee Day, Brian, so here we go.
Good.
Which country hosts the most refugees, says the UNHCR. They produced their usual little infographic video thing. Pushed out today with some statistics on it. 44,000 people forced to flee their homes every day in 2017. They said 25.4 million people are refugees. 52% of them are children. And as we move through this, actually, children is going to be a focus. Because let's have a look at this one. This is sexual violence and conflict. And again, the UN pushing out a nice little video telling us all about, this is NATO rather, telling us all about their role in trying to prevent sexual violence in conflict. So that's fantastic. The British government got involved in this as well because they had pushed out Lord Ahmed, who was speaking yesterday, on two separate issues. One on the issue of women's taking part in the political process in Syria, and also on sexual violence and conflict. He said, together we've made real progress since the time that the UK launched our campaign to prevent sexual violence in conflict in 2012. The campaign itself across the world has raised awareness of the horror and scale of sexual violence, as well as the need to tackle accountability and ensure victim support and to take action against to tackle stigma. And then he started focusing on children because, of course, as a result of sexual violence, he says, children are born and often those children experience extreme forms of stigma from communities, from families, from they're excluded from school, they're denied medical treatment, they're subject to physical violence and worse. And he said, we as policymakers are not sufficiently focused on their plight as part of our overall approach to sexual violence and conflict. I visited Iraq recently, and in that challenging situation, I did see positive examples. And that's why today I would like to invite all of us collectively, partners working side by side, to join in pledging support for the children born of sexual violence and conflict. These are innocent children. And as we in the UK prepare to host an international meeting in November 2019, 5 years on from the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence and Conflict, we want to put them at the heart, the children at the heart and centre of that particular event. So he's certainly not going to do anything about it before November 2019 when they're holding their big gala performance. I really am not really sure what to say about this, Vanessa, if we bring you in at this point, because, he was also talking yesterday about women's participation in the Syrian political process. And he was saying that, of course, there many women were experiencing sexual violence as a result of the conflict. We've got this, I think this is an EU event, Department for International Development EU event taking place today. Women's participation in the Syrian political process. But the fact that the focus is always on children, even in that photograph there, your attention is brought to the child. Nobody at any point is suggesting that we stop the conflict in the first place.
No, and I mean, this is extraordinary. And it brings us back to the question of international law. We seem to keep coming back to this, is that if these organizations, media outlets, think tanks, NATO-aligned NGOs were focusing in on international law, surely, you know, this conflict would never have started. Many of the pre-existing conflicts would not have started, and we wouldn't actually have the issues of children in conflict. And so, therefore, you know, we're consistently supporting the symptoms of the cause that has been generated by the very people that are setting up the organizations to contend with the symptoms. And if we look at who's organizing this women conference, of course, it's independent diplomat run by Foreign Office stooge Karen Ross, who we know has been effectively advocating and lobbying for the Syrian opposition, the so-called moderate opposition, with funding from the Conflict Stability and Security Fund, among other entities within the British government. Interesting as well that I find that this event is being moderated by a journalist from the BBC. I'm not quite sure how that works, but an interesting aspect to this event as well. And I would also like to add that, you know, pre-2011, the number of women in positions of power and influence in Syria probably outnumbered any other country in the Middle East, particularly, of course, client states like Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
If I could just come in there, I'm fascinated, as you are, with this lady Imogen Faulks from the BBC. Mm. I just had a little look at her Twitter page. She's getting very excited about how the war criminals in Syria are going to be dealt with. Peace first, justice when, what will happen to hashtag Syria's war criminals? What she won't be mentioning, of course, is BBC's own charity, BBC Media Action, that boasted of helping to stir up the trouble in Syria. But it amused me that she's retweeted a tweet about Ed Miliband. And this is what it says. He lies about crime in Britain. He lies about crime in Germany. He lies about and defends his cruel, inhumane, barbaric policy of separating babies and children at the border. A new low even for him, and in less than 4 weeks, Theresa May will roll out the red carpet, really. So this lady is in an interesting space because she's boasting that, of course, she's reporting mainly on the UN from Switzerland. But we'll see how she reacts to a question about how BBC Media Action was helping to inflame the warfare that caused the trouble with families and children in the first place.
Right, now let's have a look.
And also, sorry, just to interrupt there, I mean, it's also worth mentioning to her about Robert Stewart's investigation, of course, into Panorama's Saving Syria's Children. Well, that surely must have prominence in questions to a representative from the BBC defending women and children in Syria.
Absolutely. Now, Vanessa, you discovered this morning from the National Coalition of Syrian Revolutionaries and Opposition Forces, MUSA. And she is saying EU has important role in stabilising liberated areas.
Yeah, I actually had to read that a couple of times to comprehend that what she describes as the liberated areas are, of course, the terrorist occupied areas. So the areas occupied by the Western-backed so-called moderate opposition, such as Jaish al-Islam, Faik al-Rahman, who've just left Eastern Ghouta, of course, after the real liberation. So, you know, it's a confusing use of language there. It actually threw me for a couple of minutes. You know, I mean, this is quite an extraordinary event that she's talking about, EU stabilization in these so-called free liberated areas that are occupied largely by extremist terrorist militant factions that are financed by the Gulf states, Turkey, and NATO member states. So already the language is a little bit extraordinary. But if we go back in time a little bit to the previous Supporting the Future of Syria in the Region conference in April, and we look at the funding that was raised here, Mike, I mean, this is quite extraordinary. The conference succeeded in mobilizing aid to Syrians inside the country, including for hosting communities through pledges totaling $4.4 billion for 2018. Now, what is sort of shocking about this, $4.4 billion is a huge number. Of course, you know, we don't know what will materialize from those pledges, but nevertheless, even looking at the pledges, that's a huge sum. Mobilizing aid to Syrians, well, which Syrians? The 85% of the Syrian population that is living in the inhabited areas that are protected by the Syrian government and the Syrian Arab Army, or the very small, probably now less than 10%, living in the terrorist-controlled areas of Idlib and in the south, which is in the process of being really liberated by real Syrians in the Syrian Arab Army. And so, you know, the actual territory that this aid is effectively going to is rapidly shrinking. I mean, I just, you know, the lack of transparency, the hypocrisy in the language that they use, the obfuscation of the facts on the ground, the presenting of Syria as yet again this 10% sliver of reality compared to the 90% that is really going on inside Syria. And where is all this money going?
Well, that's a very good question. Now, just before we ask that question in a bit more detail, we should just make the point that this lady, in fact, was working at one point up until August with Mayday Rescue.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. She was operations manager, actually, at Mayday Rescue. Mayday Rescue, of course, was established by James Mazurier, who, while he was working with the ARC group in 2013, set up the White Helmets in Istanbul and Jordan. 1 year later, he created Mayday Rescue. And Mayday Rescue, when you look at the Foreign Office funding, and I recommend actually that everybody goes and looks at these documents that are available publicly. It's the UK FCO funding over £25,000 per month. So if you just Google search that, you can come up with it on a monthly basis. Mayday Rescue are receiving, for example, in March, they received around 3 million from the UK Foreign Office. Now, is this 3 million part of the Conflict Stability and Security Fund's 39 million funding that we know has gone directly to the White Helmets, or is it separate? You know, again, there's this complete lack of transparency, and in recommending people to go and look at this document that shows the funding over 25,000, where is the transparency? I mean, there's a number of organisations that are receiving large amounts of money from the British government, including a lot of media foundations and media training centres that I had, when I looked at it, I had absolutely no idea who they are. Where is the transparency on this? What are we doing with these funds?
Well, we're going to come on to the issue of transparency in a moment.
I just wanted to come in and say that while you've been talking, Vanessa, prompted by my memories of how Libya was dealt with, where, of course, the moment the violence and the fighting had died down, in came Common Purpose. I see that Common Purpose has now got a program for Syrian leaders in the diaspora, and it's aiming to build their capacity to contribute to Syria.
Also, Brian, that's an interesting point, because if you remember, Mike, we talked about the International War and Peace Reporting Organization based in Istanbul that has as its head the founder of Common Purpose. And that is actually still receiving, I noticed IWPR is still receiving funding from the UK Foreign Office.
Yeah, that's David Bell you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, look, I keep saying we're going to come on to transparency. We will in one second. But just before we do that, because you were speaking about the White Helmets, so let's talk about this report from Georgetown Security Studies Review. This is Georgetown University. And the headline is Syrian Civil Defense, a Framework for Demobilization and Reconstruction in Post-Conflict Syria. What is this? Are they already building the narrative for what the White Helmets are going to do should the West actually succeed in getting rid of the Assad government?
Yeah, well, I mean, this was interesting. This was written in 2015, which is when I picked it up. And this is where I actually made the connection clearly between James Lemessurier, who, of course, was in Kosovo and was very probably, although it's hard to trace him because all of his tracks have been wiped clean. But he was working at that point, having left the army, I believe, or having left the military, was working in what he called, you know, the humanitarian sector. But of course, they relate the White Helmets in the article to the transition of the KLA, the Kosovo Liberation Army, in other words, the extremist factions, to the Kosovo Protection Corps. So the transition from terrorist to humanitarian and security. And of course, what we're seeing with the White Helmets are known militant and extremist members of extremist brigades in Syria also crossing over into the White Helmets, particularly among the leadership of the White Helmets. But what's also interesting in this article, and actually I hadn't spotted it before, I must have somehow not read it correctly, but in the article, Lemessurier admits it is unrealistic to expect the Syria civil defense members, the White Helmets, the majority of whom come from majority Sunni communities, which is exactly what we've always been saying, to remain neutral on a personal level. That's actually quite a big admission in 2015. Of course, I doubt very much he would say it these days because of the accusations that have been levied at the White Helmets of sectarian extremist violence, etc. But this is a very clear admission on his part that this organization is a partisan organization and is not a neutral one. But yeah, I mean, basically what they've obviously been doing or what the White Helmets were perceived to be is working on the Kosovo blueprint. They were designed to take over as the security and allegedly humanitarian organization once the EU or the NATO member states had secured regime change and destabilization inside Syria.
Okay, well, look, let's move on to this issue of transparency then. And this is a bit of an interesting report from Publish What You Fund, which is an NGO, of course. They say that they envisage a world where aid and development information is transparent, available and used for effective decision making, public accountability and lasting change for all citizens. So it's change agency once again. But they have just published their 2018 Aid Transparency Index. Now, what I find interesting about this, Vanessa, is that, first of all, the UK Department for International Development is right at the top of the list in third place. But as we scan on down through the list here, we go through the various UNICEF and the various European Union organizations, US, Australia, and so on. The World Bank there, Denmark, US Defence. And so we go on down and we find that pretty close to the bottom, actually, I think that what is that, sixth from the end, is the UK Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Now, these two organisations, DFID and the UK Foreign and Commonwealth Office, are kind of two sides of the same coin, as it were. So it's a bit surprising, perhaps, that they find that one is extremely transparent and one is not very transparent, because my experience is that neither of them is terribly transparent.
No, and you know we've seen recently some of the FOI Freedom of Information requests put in, and some of the questions asked of Alistair Burt in Parliament, which included had the British government, I believe, had any contact with Arar Sham, one of the extremist factions that has not yet been designated a terrorist organisation, although Russia has always pushed for it to be designated as thus. Because of the atrocities it's carried out inside Syria, and also whether they were funding Jaish al-Islam and Arar Sham. And the answer back, bearing in mind this is taxpayer contributions, of course, that is being used for these financing operations inside Syria, the answer came back that they had funded members of the moderate opposition, but they were not at liberty to reveal their names because they needed to protect those entities. So effectively what Alistair Burt was saying was, well, yes, we're funding the extremist and militant factions inside Syria. We are fomenting regime change and insurgency, which is violation of international law, but we're not going to tell you the names of those organizations in case they then come under attack. I mean, you know, there's the transparency for you. But of course, our government is not going to reveal their motives in Syria to that extent.
And of course, they were equally transparent when, as a result of one Freedom of Information request, they did admit that the White Helmets send them monthly financial statements. So they're funded, they send back monthly financial statements. But when they were asked for copies of the monthly financial statements, they absolutely refused to give those. So total transparency there. Okay, look, we'll move on. Well, the delightful Nikki Haley, let's see what she had to say.
For too long, the Human Rights Council has been a protector of human rights abusers and a cesspool of political bias. Regrettably, it is now clear that our call for reform was not heeded. Human rights abusers continue to serve on and be elected to the council. The world's most inhumane regimes continue to escape scrutiny, and the Council continues politicizing and scapegoating of countries with positive human rights records in an attempt to distract from the abusers in their ranks. Therefore, as we said we would do a year ago, if we did not see any progress, the United States is officially withdrawing from the UN Human Rights Council. In doing so, I want to make it crystal clear that this step is not a retreat from human rights commitments. On the contrary, we take this step because our commitment does not allow us to remain a part of a hypocritical and self-serving organization that makes a mockery of human rights.
A hypocritical and self-serving organization. Well, Boris Johnson said the United States' decision to withdraw from the Human Rights Council is regrettable. Federica Mogherini said the U.S. has always been at the forefront of protection of human rights around the world. Today's decision risks undermining the role of the U.S. as a champion and supporter of democracy on the world stage. So that is, those are fantastic statements from those two. But if we remember that Saudi Arabia is on the Human Rights Council, Haley talking about hypocrisy, of course, Saudi Arabia is still receiving plenty of weapons from the United States. We're not going to worry too much about that. But as a general point, Vanessa, does Nikki Haley not have a point that this is a hypocritical organization? And what more can we say?
Well, I did wonder if somebody was stood in front of her with a very big mirror while she was talking.
I don't think she appears in mirrors, Vanessa.
I mean, basically what she's saying is stop picking on Israel. I mean, that's what the bottom line comes down to here. It's very clear. The level of hypocrisy in that little excerpt there is just, I don't think I need to comment on it. But what is interesting is when you bear in mind those comments, and then you bear in mind the resurgence today of the story of widespread torture in the prisons in the south of Yemen, for example, that have been set up by the United Arab Emirates, by the UAE, with, according to reports last year, with the US in place as interrogators in those prisons. So, let's have a look at those human rights abuses, both on the behalf of the Saudi Arabia coalition in Yemen, with the widespread bombing campaigns, humanitarian blockade and sanctions, etc., but then also the UAE-US collusion in the torture centres and the areas that have been taken back by the Saudi coalition in the south. And last year, I actually spoke to Mohammed Al-Wazir of Arwa Rights, ARWA Rights, if people want to follow them. They're an excellent NGO, an independent NGO, set up by a number of Yemenis to follow the human rights abuses inside Yemen since the war started in March 2015. And in combination with the Yemeni Legal Center for Rights and Development, they have recorded the number of cases of torture, abduction, violation of human rights carried out by the US and the UAE in the south of Yemen. So, you know, that's without going into the widespread torture, detention, murder of Palestinians by the Zionist regime. If we're talking about human rights violating regimes, those who are the client states of the United States are probably the worst human rights violators on the planet today.
Okay, well, look, it is International Refugee Day, but it is also, it is International Refugee Day. So to celebrate that, the European Union is holding an event about the EU's role in protecting refugee children. And as I said at the beginning of the programme, it all comes down to children at the end of the day, it seems. And this is apparently to commemorate World Refugee Day. They're pleased to invite everyone to a conference, the EU's role in protecting children, prevention of child marriage and safeguarding child welfare, organised by the Human Rights Without Frontiers International and SB Overseas, with the support of the European Parliament Anti-Racism and Discrimination Intergroup and European Parliament Intergroup on Children's Rights. It's amazing how many of these organisations exist. And yet children's rights never seem to improve under these circumstances.
Well, the name that comes into my head, Mike, is Rowley Post, the lady who was working for the EU and went to the EU with evidence of the abuse and trafficking of children in Romania. And of course, she was threatened and hounded and victimised and forced out of her job by the European Union. So we're back into the realms of gross hypocrisy.
Absolutely. So they are running a couple of sessions on child marriage and on safeguarding child welfare with people from UNICEF, people from Human Rights Without Frontiers and so on. Do you see anything productive coming out of this, Vanessa?
No.
By
the way, just coming back to Roly Post, there is an independent Dutch interview with Roly Post that has just been published, or rather it was broadcast on the 5th of May, but it's just been translated into English, French, and a number of other languages. So I'll be publishing that up at 21st Century Wire as soon as I get a chance. It's very interesting and an in-depth interview with Roly Post to solve for, as you quite rightly say, Brian, is now under increasing and intensified pressure and is really suffering as a result of the whistleblowing that she did on the illegal trafficking and adoption of children across countries.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you very much, Vanessa. Thank you for joining us. I know you've got to run, but just before you go, I just want to remind everybody that Reverend Andrew Ashton will be speaking at the Rye Bakery in Froome on Friday, this Friday coming, beginning at 6 p.m. You'll be at this event?
Yes, I will be. I'm really looking forward to it. I hope everyone comes down to listen to Andrew.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for joining us today, Vanessa. And a quick reminder that AV9 DVD is available on the UK Column website. And a reminder that tonight is the, in fact, that's the wrong date on there because this, of course, is the 20th. But tonight is the UK Column meeting in the George in Plimpton.
That's a typo, not a mistake, of course.
It doesn't Brad make is. It fake news because the event is actually taking place.
Yeah.
Okay. Digital courts, the court reform situation is continues apace in the UK. And I've got Sir Brian Leveson on screen there because, of course, he was the man that that sort of fronted up the whole transformation agenda for the court system going back 3 or 4 years now. But the government has just released some new information on this, and I just wanted to run through the scope of the types of reforms that they're talking about here. So they're talking about video remand hearings. So remand hearings to be conducted directly from police stations, custody suites, through video. And that means that any pretrial work is going to be managed by video. Online pleas, you're going to be able to enter a plea online, no problem there. Case progression, no case progression hearings. You'll just go in do this via video or the telephone. Digital markup. Well, if they do digital markup court hearings, then perhaps people will get access to court transcripts a lot faster, if at all, because at the moment, quite often, they can't get access to court transcripts. So maybe that's one positive thing in this list. But generally, this isn't terribly positive. Criminal court end-to-end. So they're really attempting to digitise criminal court proceedings from one end to the next. Civil enforcement, this is where it starts getting particularly worrying. Reviewing the structure of civil enforcement to deliver better information, increased likelihood of a successful enforcement. Well, we've been talking on UK Column News and UK Column in general for quite some time on the fact that when there's enforcement proceedings taken against somebody for whatever reason through the civil courts, that quite often bailiffs are turning up to repossess a home or repossess a car, whatever it happens to be. They're turning up without the proper paperwork. And this is just going to make the situation even worse. Family public law, they're saying that the project will transform our public family law function to enable users, including local authorities, to start and manage cases online for all public family law and adoption cases. They're talking about an end-to-end solution for adoption cases. So let's make sure that it's as quick and efficient and painless for the perpetrators, as it were, as possible, perhaps not for the children. It is interesting to note here, if I can just find this, that they're talking about court of protection. People using the court of protection will be able to initiate and manage their cases online. Well, who uses the court of protection? That's usually people that are trying to take property from older people, right?
Of course.
So I find this particularly concerning under the veneer of efficiencies and making it less expensive to access justice in this country, that what in fact we're doing is removing justice and making it easier for the corrupt, shall we call them, to ply their wares without any sort of accountability.
Yeah. I think this is immensely dangerous, Mike. And Brian Leveson, who is Brian Leveson? Okay, he's a senior judge. What are his views and values? We have no idea, but let's remember what he was doing. A couple of years ago, he was spearheading the attempt of the state to absolutely close down free speech.
Yes.
He's been working to close down free speech and free media, free press. Now he's moved across to closing down the courts. And of course, what people know who attend court on a regular basis is nothing beats publicity. Having the press there, having a jury there, having the public in those courts is vital for ensuring that proper justice is carried out. So I think this is very sinister, very dangerous. Let's give an example and remind people that Melanie Shaw, child abuse whistleblower, is still held in prison 18 days over her release date. No explanation, no documentation, no reports from Melanie herself. So Melanie, who was abused but blew the whistle on child abuse at Beechwood Children's Home, Nottingham, which has implications through to Westminster, she is silenced by the state and we have no idea on what basis she's now being held. And of course, she suffered with the use of so-called digital justice, because on at least two occasions, instead of going into court and being able to tell her side of the case, she was simply held and then for some reason the video link didn't work.
Yeah.
So this, Melanie, is a classic example.
I just want to say that one of our members contacted Stile Prison and asked why Melanie had not yet been released. And the answer that came back was, we can't discuss that because of data protection.
Yeah.
So once again, they're hiding behind Data Protection Act.
Hiding behind, they do not want the truth. They don't want transparency. They don't want the public to see what's going on. If the state is involved in stealing children, which the British state is, whether it's UK or overseas, you've got to do that in the dark. Mm-hmm. It's very easy. So we just put up this graphic. If anybody out there is not aware of Melanie Shaw, there's several articles on the UK Column website, and you can have a read what all this is about. But don't forget that at the time Melanie was convicted, it was Theresa May who was Home Secretary. This is Theresa May, now Prime Minister, the woman who admits her department once again lost evidence of child abuse. But Melanie had to go to prison. There are other convicted paedophiles or convicted abusers walking the streets at the moment, still not been to prison. Melanie, as abuse survivor, is in prison. I don't think we showed you the full document to which we were referring before, but this is the actual release date notification slip that was given in Eastwood Park to Melanie. And if you go down to the highlighted section, it says very clearly the sentence expiry date is the 2nd of June 2018, but there is absolutely no sign of Melanie. And because her communications are largely interfered with, we have no idea why this lady is still in prison. So here we are, whilst the UK sits on the world stage, United Nations, talking about human rights in UK itself, we are at the stage where we have what are known as black prisoners, prisoners who are simply taken off the streets, held in prison with no proper due process. And perhaps most sinister of all, there has been utter silence from Theresa May's supposedly independent inquiry into child abuse on the subject of not only Melanie Shaw, where is she? She needs to come forward and give her evidence to the inquiry. But also the inquiry promised that they would make it easier for other child abuse survivors who are in prison to give their evidence. No sign at all of any movement by the inquiry on that promise.
Right. The British government's AI bot has been speaking out again. This is Matthew Hancock, Secretary of State for Digital Culture, Media and Sport. And he's written an article in The Telegraph. The headline is "Schools Must Play a Part in Protecting Our Children in the Digital Age." He was then followed this up by speaking to the NSPCC. And he's particularly concerned about the use of mobile phones, apparently, in schools. He said technology makes being a parent much harder. and schools have a big role to play. I enthusiastically support using technology for teaching, but we also need to teach children how to stay safe with technology. Why do young children need mobile phones in schools? And so he goes on. Now, the key point here is that, of course, this is once again reinforcement of the concept of corporate parenting, Brian, because this isn't a decision for parents, real parents. This is a decision for the schools to make. We don't need to encourage parents to sort of not permit their children to take mobile phones to school. We've got to make sure it's the schools making those decisions and the schools bringing up our children on our behalf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very dangerous stuff. Well, if that's coming in from Matt Hancock, have a look at this headline. This is just an amazing story, and I encourage people to go and read the full thing. GCHQ boss warns EU it will suffer without a Brexit security deal as he wades into the row by revealing agency helped foil four plots in the past year. On it goes. He said the EU faces a heightened terror threat if it chooses to limit security cooperation with the UK after Brexit. In an unprecedented intervention, GCHQ boss Jeremy Fleming warned that the bloc would suffer at the hands of hostile foreign powers or terrorist groups if it decided to cut ties. Well, we'll drill into this story, but there's one question we need to ask first of all. Where is the evidence that GCHQ foiled four terrorist plots? I understand that if you are conducting difficult intelligence operations, you can't simply put all of your know-how into the hands of the public. But I also know it's perfectly possible to put enough across to demonstrate that what you're saying is true. But what we get from GCHQ, and we've had it from MI5 and MI6, is the claim they are doing this good work to protect the British public, but no evidence is ever put forward. So let's have a look at this man himself. Here he is. And what has he got to say? Well, he said this, amongst a lot of other things. We've not forgotten the old foes. For decades, we've collected intelligence on Russian capability. For over 20 years, we've countered the growing cyber threat they pose to the UK and our allies. Recent events are particularly stark and shocking. The attack on the Skripals in Salisbury was the first time a nerve agent was deployed in Europe since the Second World War. That's sobering. It demonstrates how reckless Russia is prepared to be, how little the Kremlin cares for the international rules-based order, how comfortable they are at putting ordinary lives at risk. So it's fascinating that if they've been doing this great job for 20 years, how do we end up in the position at the moment where our armed forces and intelligence services have been completely outflanked by the Russians in almost every theatre? And I'm very curious about his reference to the use of nerve agents since the Second World War. To my knowledge, nerve agents were not used in combat in the Second World War. So I'm not quite sure what he's referring to here.
Right.
But we'll leave people to think about that. But of course, this is all anti-Russian rhetoric from this man. And what we've got is a civil servant who should be apolitical, I think, under his job status, now becoming an aggressive political activist. So I'm going to suggest this is a very dangerous man in charge of a very powerful organisation. But he goes on. He says the robust response from the UK and the international community shows the Kremlin that illegal acts have consequences, and it looks like our expertise on Russia will be in increasing demand. We will continue to expose Russia's unacceptable cyber behaviour. It's like some perverted school teacher thinking he's giving somebody a lecture here. But what this is an advert for GCHQ. We're doing a brilliant job, so good we can't tell you. Everything is those naughty Russians. We're not going to tolerate their behaviour. What's the British public know about the true activities of this organisation? And we can ask ourselves that if they're all so effective, why didn't they stop the Skripal poisoning plot in the first place, Mike?
Because they did it.
Because they did it.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, let's have a look at some of the comments we could find on this man. And we came up against Sir Mark Lyle Grant. He was the national security advisor for Theresa May, but he had to resign after mansplaining. This was a new word, new speak. I had to look it up, but apparently it's when a man makes a demeaning comment to a woman, and presumably he spoke a little bit harshly to Theresa May, so he had to go. But this man said that Fleming was a national security professional of the highest standard, who's widely respected across the national security community in the UK and overseas. So I don't know whether that's mansplaining comment as well, but the man who praised our Mr. Fleming had to go. So we got sort of praise from a discredited person. But this is what I found really shocking. I'm going to use that word because here's Mr. Fleming giving a speech on what he called Cyber UK leadership. This is all very, very newspeak, but have a look at what this man talks about. He said, in the world we operate, he's always been an optimist. He didn't fear Asimov's three rules of robotics, the threat of Skynet taking over or the menacing voice of HAL. I like to see the wider social promise in technology, not the threat. He says that things previously unimaginable are already commonplace, and he talks about tablets. He says, scanning the horizon, there's so much to excite us, the idea of hyperconnectivity, the Internet of Things, if people don't know what that is, every single object and component will be digitally marked and databased, making the links and activity with them intuitive, instantaneous, the power of analytics to improve social services and transform healthcare, the benefit of playing games, for example, using Pokemon Go to break down intimidating social barriers for children with autism, the use of augmented reality to make the scary familiar. Imagine helping your child to find their way around a hospital. This is the boss of GCHQ, apparently on a social crusade to improve our lives through pushing in technology people are regarding as ever more dangerous. Mm. I think this man is immensely dangerous, and it gets better because he says over the next 18 months, 5G is coming. We can see how it will change app development, how it will alter irreversibly the speed at which we can connect the world. Of course, there are dangers and pitfalls. We must look for equality in this digital revolution because there's a widening gulf between the capacity for connectivity in rural areas and cities. 5G in all its glory will come at a price that will be beyond many. That's the subject for another time, but I know our colleagues in the Department for Digital Culture, Media and Sport are working hard to make sure nobody is left behind. This man is describing with great pride a brave new world, Mike, yeah, where he knows that ever more devices are coming into society which are going to allow him to spy on every part of people's lives. And I'll give you the last bit, but I'm going to encourage people to go and find this talk. He says, while we face an emboldened Russia, we also see the tectonic plates in the Middle East moving. We see Iran and its proxies meddling throughout the region, the use of chemical weapons in Syria. We're watching the dispersal of Daesh fighters, serious crime gangs smuggling people from Eastern Europe and Northern Africa. He's too right here because we're the ones creating this. So I don't know what our viewers would say. I encourage people to go and have a look at this article, but I see an immensely dangerous civil servant who now thinks that he's got a political role to change the whole of society for us. And of course, he's sitting on an absolutely vast spying apparatus in GCHQ.
Today is the yesterday and today the RUSI Land Warfare Conference is taking place at the Royal United Services Institute, and today they're talking about some of these same types of themes. Brian and Anthony King from the University of Warwick made the comment this morning, first thing, that command, military command, is an inherently human capacity. We're never going to let a machine take charge of killing other human beings. That's the academic's viewpoint. Mark Lancaster, the Armed Forces Minister, didn't seem to be quite so sure about that, as you'll see as we go through this. He said, we have to look to strengthen alliances and bilateral relationships, not only with our closest allies, the US, France and Germany, but also with countries such as Ukraine, Georgia, Lithuania, who are suffering from Russia's attention. Yes. And he went on to say, our adversaries believe truth is malleable. We need to counter that and make sure the truth is heard. And then he went to talk on about autonomy and AI and so on. He said, Autonomous Warrior 2018 will see a battle group from 1st Armoury Infantry Brigade spend a month in Salisbury Plain testing some of the newest robotic technologies in collaboration with the Royal Air Force and the Royal Marines and the US military and US military observers. The division must remain the cornerstone of our military power. It is the division that can bring together decisive force from all domains and ensure interoperability at the international level required to dislocate and overwhelm an opponent. The threat of non-state actors and insurgencies is increased by the proliferation of weapon systems, which were once the sole preserve of Tier 1 military powers. And he said that Russia is preparing for major combat operations, and its use of proxies to avoid getting their hands dirty could not obscure their efforts to modernise and improve their armed forces. And then he went on to say that resource scarcity, fragile states, trade disputes, I believe these threats are as acute now as they were in 1963 when Russia warned the public of escalating dangers during the Cold War. But I just found it interesting that Anthony King was quite certain that we should never be allowing the machine to take charge of killing under other human beings. But Mark Lancaster really keen to look forward to Exercise Autonomous Warrior 2018, where they're aiming to do exactly that.
Yeah, and what a fascinating comment to say that the Russians have attempted to hide the modernisation of their military. In fact, the Russians have been proudly boasting of their ability to modernise and using, of course, production from Russia itself. So there's been no hiding. There's been quite an open statement that they were going to transform their military. And they've said they had to do that because, of course, the Americans have withdrawn from treaties which put Russian defences at risk.
But our adversaries believe the truth is malleable. The reason they believe truth is malleable is because they see how malleable the likes of Mark Lancaster and the British government makes it on a daily basis. Right.
We're on the stops for time, but we just show this one because I think it follows on so nicely. This is Air Force Time, so US report here. Study to fix Air Force pilot shortage, look to contractors and forget about warrant officers. So we've got creeping privatisation of the American military. But why have they got a problem with pilots? Well, of course, they couldn't breathe. So it says here, Brigadier General Mike Kucheski, who was in charge of a task force dedicated to fixing the pilot shortfall, told researchers he hopes to get nearly 1,400 in fiscal year 2019 and grow to 1,600 pilots a year in the years after fiscal year 2020. But getting there will be difficult. Even the plan to reach 1,200 this year had a wrench thrown in it when the Air Force's T-6 Texan II fleet was stood down due to a string of unexplained physiological events such as hypoxia. As a result, this year's expected pilot production was knocked down to around 1,100. So the fact that the American super state, super military, couldn't supply oxygen to its own pilots has resulted in depressing recruiting for pilots. And what does that mean? We're going to have to bring in those private contractors.
What I'm still not clear about is whether these other reports of hypoxia in other aircraft, which we had never heard before the F-35 came along, whether those reports were merely PR efforts to sort of dilute the effect of the hypoxia problems with the F-35 itself, in which case they've been hoisted by their own petard here.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we're going to have more to say on this because it's got implications with the British military as well. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us. And a very big thank you to the people who've signed up for subscriptions. Subscriptions so important to us as they give us a regular income. So if you're not a subscriber of UK Column, please consider becoming one. We can only do what we do with your financial support. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.